And 107.5 FM, W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Utah prosecutors say the death penalty is on the table for the suspect in the death of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk, Tyler Robinson, facing 7 counts, including aggravated murder. In the stopgap funding bill that Republicans hope to vote on this week, $30 million to guard members of Congress and their districts, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
It's not clear to me where the $30 million number came from, what it actually would fund. What's the basis of the number?
Jeffrey says Democrats won't support it. 13 wounded, 5 critically, 2 shootings just 12 hours apart in homeless encampments in Minneapolis. There were the 4th and 5th mass shootings in the city in the past 3 weeks, including one on October 27th at Annunciation Catholic School that left 2 children dead and 21 people injured. Marshall University says its president, Brad Smith, and his wife have made a substantial $50 million gift to the university to promote education. Dave Packer, ABC News.
You're listening to 107.5 WLAK, Amory's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m.
Brewers baseball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers open a 3-game series tonight against the Los Angeles Angels at American Family Field. Milwaukee with a 5-game lead over the Cubs in the NL Central. The Angels are in last place in the American League West, 13 games behind the Mariners. NFL, Matt LaFleur says the Packers' 10 penalties last Thursday night were far too many.
We went into the game. We knew that the penalties were going to be a big part of the game, and we had far too many. So, obviously, the first drive, it negated a touchdown. And then we had pre-snap penalties. You don't want any of those. We had a couple pre-snap penalties. We had a couple penalties on special teams that really played a big impact on field position.
The Packers play the Browns in Cleveland on Sunday. The Minnesota Vikings will be without their quarterback, J.J. McCarthy, the next 2 to 4 weeks. McCarthy suffering a high ankle sprain during their loss to the Falcons on Sunday night. Carson Wentz will take over at quarterback. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Frank Hermans.
When we moved here, I called the Y because my daughter was like, I don't know, 7 years old. I said, hey, I'm calling about your beginner's gymnastics class. I'm 40 years old. I've never had a gymnastics class. So do you think I should start there? Frank, I get nothing. On the other end, it's just silence. Even after she knew I was kidding.
You should tape that.
Come on. And I did take the class and I did really well.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Our vice president hosted the Charlie Kirk Show. And while doing that, a lot of nonsense, sadly, a vice president of the United States. But the part that caught my attention, he said that when you see someone celebrating Charlie's murder, call them out in hell, call their employer. Yeah. Yeah, that's going to bring people together, especially under the banner of the free speech. Because what I've noticed that if you question that Charlie Kirk was a free speech absolutist advocate, whatever, that either you shut up or we're going to cancel you. We're going to harass, intimidate. And it's weird coming from the people who tell us that they believe in free speech. And it's even weirder coming from the administration who, their supporters, do we not remember January 6th? They're the aggressive type. The Cato Institute did a little mock-up, showed that of the political violence, of the ideological violence, overwhelmingly from that side. But the White House is going to have a broad crackdown on liberal groups. Trump is going to do what conservatives believed Obama did to them, but didn't. It's the excuse. It's their moment. And the sad reality is we're again Never let a good crisis go to waste. Kirk's murder is going to be all about punishing the libs, punishing the others. So it's got me in this weird spot because working people in this country are really getting buried alive out here. And all anybody really is talking about is Kirk's murder. That shooting has taken every ounce of media oxygen out of the room. Nonstop headlines, social media, flame wars, endless memorials, and of course, your standard boilerplate political grandstanding. Meanwhile, working people get up, punch the clock, go to work, try and support their families, get hammered. The economy's not good. And the real emergencies that we, the people, working America is facing, it's not even a footnote in the national conversation. Understand, Kirk's assassination was a tragedy, was horrible. Nobody, no one should have to worry about getting shot for their opinions. No matter how unpopular they are, I don't have to listen. I can go away. But what's new here is as soon as the news broke, every cable channel, every blowhard, bloviating ex-moron, politicians who leapt into the frenzy blaming their favorite enemy or pushing wild conspiracy theories, they're there, all while working families are still trying to figure out how to put food on the table, how working families are losing jobs, losing homes, and nothing coming out of our political class. Nothing. Now, I understand we're a nation that's addicted to outrage and distraction. The sad reality is the working class, they're the recipients of most of the bad policy. But what's weird is how everyone now is supposed to drop everything and join the rally, pick the side, mourn, or sadly cheer, depending on which side of the aisle you're on. And the question I keep coming back to, who's fighting for the working people of this country? Who's fighting to make lives better, given the fact that people are getting automated out of livable work? Who's fighting for people who can't afford to go to the doctor, who have to work 2-3 jobs just to keep the lights on? Who's out there doing that? Nobody, because they need this distraction, because they know not good times ahead. And I look at this Fortune story I saw the other day that quoted this Ray Dalio. And I've talked about him before. Rich guy who's, you know, radical self-interest, doesn't want to see his head on a platter. One of the richest guys in the country, you know, he came out and said, look, AI and robotics, that's going to replace entire professions. And he predicted that, what was it, upwards of the top 10%, that they're going to reap the benefits of the efficiency and the massive productivity gains. And the rest of us, we the working people, well, you know what we're going to get. And unless there's a radical shift in our politics, in our ideology, in our policies, we're screwed. AI is killing jobs by the hundreds of thousands. Tech, office work, even skilled trades. There's nothing safe. And what Dalio is talking about is a redistribution system, a social policy, actually government working. And expecting people who don't believe in government to do that. And what's weird is nobody's asking actual working people if we want to have a jobless society, if we want to depend on benevolent billionaire largesse. The reality is we're getting sliced and diced and drawn and quartered by forces we can't control. And instead of pushing for real accountability for policies that protect workers from ruthless layoffs and wealth inequality, we're still picking sides in the circus after a senseless murder of Charlie Kirk. And my thought is, you know, go on, argue about who's to blame. It's the radical left. It's the radical right. It's the dark meme culture. It's the femboy groypers or whatever they are, whatever boogeyman is trending. And meanwhile, you've got the billionaire class who are laughing their way all the way to the bank. Wall Street celebrating. They celebrate every efficiency and every reduction in redundancy with higher profits for the very well-to-do. You, me, not so much. And as companies automate thousands of jobs out of existence, which it's going to happen, the latest outrage cycle guarantees that the public is still going to be too distracted to organize or demand better or more. I often quote a quote that's attributed to Jay Gould, the railroad magnate from the 1880s. I can pay half the working class to murder the other half. The line hurts because it's true. The more we're divided, the more we're frightened, the more we're fighting over culture wars brought to us by some charismatic pundit or figurehead, it's easier. It's easier for the 1% to keep business as usual, keep those profits rolling in, keep those pockets lined. And I wish that we as working people would put the same kind of energy into making lives better that we put into tearing each other apart. I wish there were some benevolent billionaire who would fund people who are saying, hey, we should have better lives, instead of funding pundits who are just looking for outrage, looking for attention. Look around. The biggest threats to our way of life aren't lone gunmen or Twitter bots. They're running the companies that are going to bring us runaway automation. It's the shrinking job prospects for our children. It's a political class that won't touch real problems because you don't want to upset the donors. Kirk's murder is going to be used to justify more surveillance, more heavy-handed policing, and yes, more division. And we, the working people, we're going to continue to lose our homes, our jobs, our dignity, our sanity. So the question I have is, how much longer before half the working class is set against the other half just for fun, for sport, just for a slight edge in the next election or the next quarterly report? The reality is we're living through horrible times. But there doesn't seem to be anybody who really cares about working people, who really cares about how do we have a society worth inheriting for the next generation. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back with Will Rice for Americans for Tax Fairness.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, all the oxygen out of the room with what's going on. The president, I guess, didn't show up to the funeral, which is weird. Since they're getting so much political hay out of it, you think he'd at least made the pilgrimage. Golfing is more important, evidently. But to refocus this back to where I think it was something important, and this is where, again, I'm hopeful our elected leaders hopefully move us back in this direction. So when I saw this idea of a billionaire's income tax act being introduced, I signed on immediately because something I've kind of been calling on for a long time, dig up Dwight David Eisenhower or at least his tax code. and get us back to somewhere where maybe we, income-wise, are somewhere between the curbs instead of a handful of billionaires and then, well, the rest of us. And here to share some thoughts on this idea of a billionaire's income tax, I've asked Will Rice to come talk with us. Will is a policy consultant with the folks over at Americans for Tax Fairness. You can check out their website at AmericansForTaxFairness.org. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me back on, Rick.
So, look, we've been talking about the reality that I think all the oxygen's been sucked out of the room by what's going on, and rightly so to a degree. Political violence is a big thing. But we need to get back to doing some work so people aren't so angry. Maybe getting back to making sure people got health care and decent jobs and retirement security, things that the working class of this country, I think want and need.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of this anger, a lot of this kind of chaos we're in now is because a lot of people feel the economic system is rigged against them, and they want to feel as though we're all playing by the same rules. And that's what the billionaire's income tax is trying to achieve.
So walk me through part of this. I mean, you know, I've called for, you know, like I said a moment ago, you know, at least digging up Eisenhower's tax code. Is this what we're talking about, or what?
No, this is something even I think more important. There's a lot of debate about tax rates on regular income, and I agree that they could be higher. But what most people don't understand is that the people at the very, very top of the economic pyramid, the billionaires and people making $100 million a year, are not paying taxes on their single most important form of income. It's just not taxed. And that's why a billionaire can go without paying any taxes, or if you count all of the billionaire's income, can pay a lower tax rate than a teacher or a firefighter or a nurse or a truck driver. So this billionaire's income tax finally fixes that problem by taxing that part of the income of billionaires that up till now just isn't taxed at all.
And again, you know, we've seen in situations where some of our wealthiest citizens are actually paying less than, well, I mean, Warren Buffett said it. You know, how is it possible that he, one of the richest men in the world, is paying a lower income tax rate than his secretary?
That's right. And that's because his secretary gets taxes taken out of her paycheck, you know, every 2 weeks. And that's the way most people experience taxes, is that every penny they make is taxed all year long, every year. But if you're a billionaire, or you're someone making over $100 million a year, your major source of income is the increase in the value of your investments. Now, people may say, well, those are paper profits. How can I live off that? How does that pay the rent or pay the mortgage, buy the groceries? Well, at that level, the income, the increase in the value of these investments is going up so fast, and it's already at such a high level that these people can secure low-cost loans and then live off those loans, pay the interest, but which is much less than they would pay in taxes, and live tax-free. And Wall Street even has a clever, or however you want to think about it, maybe sort of macabre term for this. It's called buy, borrow, die. And the die part is that when you die, when these massive increases in value are passed along to the next generation, they just magically disappear for tax purposes. And no tax is ever paid on those gains.
Now, how high, you know, where does this tax start? Because you threw out the number of $100 million a year, which how many of us in the 350 million people, how many of us are actually in that rarefied air?
We're only talking in the thousands of households who are either billionaires or have that much income coming in every year. So it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the very wealthiest and highest income people in this country. And yet, because there is such income inequality and such wealth inequality, and so much money is stuck at the top of the economy, just taxing those few thousands of the wealthiest would raise over $500 billion in tax revenue over 10 years. And that's money we could do serious work with to help everyone who's not a billionaire and who doesn't make $100 million.
Yeah, maybe not cut Medicaid down to the bone, exactly. Maybe not take food out of the mouths of hungry children, maybe, you know, shelter for, you know, homeless veterans, maybe something, you know, minor like those things.
Exactly. I mean, it would pay for a lot of the things that President Biden was proposing in his budgets every year. Like, you could have universal pre-K, free pre-K for every kid in America, at the same time as expanding affordable and quality childcare. You could expand the child tax credit. You could expand the earned income tax credit. You could do a lot of combinations of things with that. It's roughly estimated $557 billion over 10 years that would really help people out, that would expand opportunities, that would lower costs that they're facing, and would only inconvenience the people at the very top. And not even inconvenience them. I don't even think they'd miss the money.
Yeah, no, I mean, I look at Mackenzie Scott, who evidently is giving away billions. She's giving away, how's this go? She can't give money away fast enough for her wealth to go down because of what you had said a moment ago. It keeps going up because of the growth that's happening on Wall Street. How badly the game is rigged. She can't give money away fast enough.
That's right. It's almost like an old Hollywood movie or something, is it? When you get to this level, money just comes in at such a rate that, yeah, it actually is a problem to figure out who to give it to. And she's to be admired for giving it away. A lot of these people are just spending it on themselves, whether, you know, renting out the entire city of Venice for a wedding, buying islands, buying multiple yachts, whatever it is. But
I'm not against that. I'm not against them buying things. The problem is they can't buy enough to keep the economy going. And no. There's just not enough of them. You ever see the movie Brewster's Millions?
That's what I was thinking of when you said spending it all. Yeah.
I mean, me, that's the thing. I mean, there's only so much one person can do spending wise. And then it just accumulates in hoards. Mm-hmm. And that's from just a strictly you know, not caring about, you know, individuals, from thinking about a societal program, having that kind of distribution of wealth is bad for the economy as a whole. And it's going to get worse. As I talked about a moment ago, you got this billionaire Ray Dalio, who has talked about, you know, how bad income inequality has been, I think out of radical self-interest, because he knows when the pitchforks come out, they're going after him. Saying, look, you know, as AI and robotics and automation and all of this new stuff gets rolled out or rammed down our throats, you're going to have to figure out a way to get an economy moving, and we're doing nothing. Do you think this is part of that?
Absolutely. I mean, a lopsided economy like the one we have now destabilizes markets and it endangers democracy. Because Americans for Tax Fairness has been doing a series of reports on billionaires buying elections. And they are pouring billions of dollars into our federal elections in order to try to elect people who will cut their taxes, which gives them more money to contribute the next time the elections roll around. And it's just a vicious cycle. So the billionaire's income tax, what it would do is it would look at how much your income, how much your wealth had increased from January 1 to December 31st, and count that as income. And you would pay tax on it just as if you'd sold those assets and had to pay capital gains. You would pay the capital gains tax whether the gain was on something you sold or something you held on to. And I think most people, when they understand it that way, would see it makes a lot of sense.
Right. So just, I'm clear here, guys. I can already hear my buddies going, death, another kind of death tax frame. Because I know people who think, you know, I don't want to pay death taxes. They go, well, I would love to pay the estate tax, because it would mean I've got a lot of money and a lot to give my children. What number? I mean, a truck driver making $50,000 a year, or maybe has $100,000, in who knows what for a year. We're not talking about that guy, are we?
No, we're not at all. These are people who have $1 billion, which is such a large number, it's very hard to most of us to conceptualize what it is. Or it's possible you could have less than $1 billion, but you're making at least $100 million three consecutive years in a row. So you're consistently making $100 million. This is a tiny, tiny, very elite fraction of the American people. And at those levels, it makes perfect sense to say, well, you're really living off your, you're not getting a paycheck probably, or if you are, it's not very important. You're living off your Wall Street winnings, and we're going to tax those Wall Street winnings every year, just like we're taxing the truck drivers on their paycheck every year.
Yeah, the gambling. So I remember a couple years ago, and again, this is your world. You'll probably remember better than I would, but a guy named David Tepper made like $4 billion in a year on a couple of Wall Street bets. That was 1 year. He wouldn't get hit for that 1 year. He could keep his $4 billion, right? For the 1 year.
Yeah. If at the end of the year he wasn't worth $4 billion, if he'd somehow spent it all or something.
No, because you said three consecutive years.
Oh, well, of $100 million.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you're right at the $1 billion line and you're fluctuating back and forth, I'm sure they'll come up with a system for that. But right now the consistency is about the $100 million income.
Okay,
billionaires. So, if you're a billionaire, you're a billionaire.
Yeah, because I just want to make sure that they're taken care of, because we might need to have some kind of billionaire adjustment fund, because they may have had some. Look, you know, given the Congress that we have right now, that the only thing legislatively that they've done is given rich people more with that nightmare bill of Trump's. Nothing is beyond them. So, you know, for me, I listen to this billionaire income tax act and I'm like, yeah, great. So I got to ask you, as someone who's kind of the insider here, any chance that this gets support from both sides of the aisle? Or is this a messaging bill going, hey, this is what we should be doing and this is what we should be organizing behind?
Well, if politicians paid attention to the polling, and I mean on both sides of the aisle, you would have Republican support for this, because Democrats, independents, and Republicans, Trump voters consistently say they think the super rich should pay more in taxes. So it's a rare area of consensus in the country, actually, is that rich people and corporations should pay more in taxes. It's really only because those rich people can pour billions of dollars into campaigns and distract us to other issues that this is not more popular and more bipartisan, because it should be.
No, and look, you know, like, you know, sad reality is the last several days we've been talking about Charlie Kirk. You wouldn't hear about Charlie Kirk without billionaire money from Foster Freeze and a couple of others who supercharged that message. So again, this for me is another one of those important things. But where I want to kind of end up is. This is because you said something about, you know, Republican voters and Trump's voters. These are voters. These aren't the politicians. It's the voters who should be demanding this of their elected officials, because and I think in a preemptive way, because as we've just talked about, the reality is a lot of jobs are going to be lost. There's going to be massive efficiency, massive productivity gains. But it's only going to be shared, as this Ray Dalio, one of the billionaires, it says, is it's only going to be shared by between 1 and 10% of the population. That means between 90 and 99% of us are screwed. So something like this for a redistributive policy sounds reasonable to be pursuing, no?
Absolutely. I mean, with AI, there's going to be a lot of jobs disappearing. And I just want to throw in a few other points to the extent that your listeners are concerned about the poor billionaires. If your wealth, if the value of your investments goes down in a year, you don't owe anything on this tax. So it's not how much money you have, it's whether that money is going up or down. So if you have three losing years in a row, no tax. The other thing I want to say is,
yeah, they don't ever lose. I'm sorry.
But if it were to happen, they would not face a tax.
Okay, in that world that we really have to pretend like we care about the poor billionaires, okay.
The other thing is, some things are easier to assess the value of than others. So if all your money's in the stock market, it's very easy to see how much has gone up in value over the year. If it's in a private business or real estate, you might not know. And in the case of those hard-to-assess things, you still don't pay the tax until you sell the asset, although you pay a little interest on those years when you should have been paying it if we'd all known the price.
Or so if it's in the Cayman Islands.
It's a fair tax both to the mass of the people who think that billionaires should be paying more, and it's even fair to the billionaires. So and it's also good for the billionaires, because, as you say, they don't want the pitchforks coming out.
Nope,
and this is one way that we can forestall that.
So last question I've got for you. What do we do? How do we move this? How do we gain support? What do we do? What do you want?
call your member of Congress. The bill is being introduced on Wednesday by Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat of Oregon, and a companion bill in the House of Representatives. So call your senators, call your member of the representative, your member of the House of Representatives, and say you want the billionaires' income tax, that you want them to support, you want them to co-sponsor, you want them to vote for the billionaires' income tax.
There you go. AmericansForTaxFairness.org, the website. Will Rice, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you, and I got great hope. I hope this at least gets moving.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much again for having me on.
Thanks, Will. Appreciate it. Want to hear your thoughts. On board? Do you think it's something we need? Start taxing the billionaires? Maybe start having some redistributive policies to make sure that, I don't know, kids get fed, veterans find homes, stuff. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
107.5 WLAK, Amory's real news and great conversation, and home to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, warm and muggy with a low in the mid-60s. Hot and humid again tomorrow, high in the mid-80s, some showers and storms in the late afternoon, with increasing clouds throughout the day. Storm chances continue tomorrow night, Thursday, and Friday. Currently at 75 degrees.
This is Robert Pilot, host of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we talk about Native issues like treaties, protecting Mother Earth, and holding our elected officials accountable. You'll also hear from Turtle Island voices like Arvina Martin, State Representative Heather Keeler, Ruth Anna Buffalo, Dr. Anthony Stately, State Senator Mary Kunish, Robert Lilligren, and Bob Blake. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, we've spent an awful lot of time over the last several days talking about Charlie Kirk and talking about free speech, especially now that evidently I found out, and like I said, a moment ago, I found out that Charlie was a free speech advocate, and to say otherwise, you shut up. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of where we are. But what we're not talking about, and this is where my problem is, and going forward, back to talking about what I think is really important, the fact that workers' lives are not getting any better under this administration, that all of this chaos is for chaos' sake to ensure that we aren't talking about wages, we're not talking about health care, we're not talking about Trump's frontal assault on workers' rights, or even the government shutdown that's on the horizon. And here to share some thoughts on all of that and, well, maybe everything else we can get into, I've asked Sarah Steffens to come talk with us. She's the Worker Power Director there at the Progressive Caucus Action Fund. You can check out their website at the Congressional Progressive Caucus Center at progressivecaucuscenter.org. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, I'm going to start in this position. Look, there's been a lot of talk about, all the stuff that's going on, all the chaos. But again, we're not talking about how we're making lives better. Our politics seems to be broken and not accomplishing things for working people. So this seems like, one of those moments where maybe recentering what we should be fighting for, I think, kind of important.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's very clear that in 2025, in the first months of the Trump administration, life for workers, especially union workers, but all workers, has gotten a lot worse. And I think that's something we all need to be paying attention to. Nobody thought that the Trump administration was going to be pro-worker. I mean, I guess some people did, but none of us in the labor movement were expecting that. But we have seen the exact opposite. The greatest single act of union busting in our nation's history, with drawing union rights from about a million federal workers, paralyzed the NLRB by firing Gwen Wilcox, traumatizing the federal workers who remain, canceling of research and grants, withdrawing investments that were building good union jobs in fields like clean energy. It's really been an absolute disaster for working people. Yeah. And we all need to be talking about that.
Absolutely. So when the right talks about, cancel culture, This is the kind of cancel culture that I'm concerned about, canceling those good jobs. All I heard for years was Joe Biden canceled the Keystone XL. This cancellation of Revolution Wind is multiple times worse, and yet crickets on the right when talking about these job losses.
Yeah, and you know, you are union siblings at LIUNA and IBEW are just besides themselves that their union members were actually sent home from a job that was 80% done. How is that standing up for working people? How is that rebuilding jobs for American workers to literally cancel a project that was building good work for lots of American families when it was almost done?
So the question then comes back to, you know, we know what Republicans were going to do. Let me ask you this. Are you surprised by how fast Trump's done the things he's done? Or like me, I actually thought it was going to be worse. I thought we were going to be in a worse position at this point. It's going to get worse, but I thought that they would have gone a lot faster. And everybody I talked to, I'm surprised. How could you be surprised in this moment, having read Project 2025 and listened to that campaign?
I mean, if you read Project 2025, you knew that this was going to be bad for unions, bad for workers and workers' rights. I think what's surprising is the reality of living in this kind of onslaught where so many things are happening at once. I will say it was not on my 2025 bingo card that he would fire Gwen Wilcox. You know, it wasn't even a necessary. The National Labor Relations Board goes back, you know, back and forth with different viewpoints between administrations. No president has ever fired somebody from the National Labor Relations Board before. So that's surprising. But it's not just that. It's that in combination with the, you know, not just changing the schedule for federal workers, but this broad EO to withdraw union recognition for more than a million workers. And then coupled with just a relentless war on so many fronts against workers' rights, whether it's your right to overtime, wages for low-paid home care workers. You could have, anyone who was really paying attention, people in the labor movement could have and did point into all of these things as risk. But what it feels like for workers in the labor movement to have this happening, you know, day after day after day, I think that's what's surprising. It's been hard, I think, for people to figure out, you know, how do we get people united? How do we fight back? How do we make sure that we're continuing to organize and, most importantly, pressing some sort of a positive vision of what it is we want for working people in this country?
And this is why I'm reaching out to you guys, because, you know, I have people reaching out to me going, hey, you know, what are Democrats doing? What are progressives doing? What's going on in D.C.? Is there anything? Because the message that we're getting from the mainstream corporate controlled media is that, you know, Democrats are, you know, basically dithering and powerless and you know, kind of in a desert, not knowing where they're going. You know, you had John Fetterman over the weekend saying that, you know, Democrats, you know, they didn't learn from the reason they lost or whatever crazy statement he's been coming out with. It seems that the narrative is that nothing's happening. So give me some hope here.
Well, I'm not sure if this is the hope that you're looking for, but I think that it's not that there's a lack of ideas or a lack of vision for what working people need in this country. We know we need more unions, a safer, easier way to organize unions, less retaliation, better wages, better benefits, dignity, and a voice on the job. We know all these things. There have been many versions of labor law reform we've seen over the years. There's lots of interesting progressive ideas about sectoral bargaining. Raising minimum wages obviously is something we've needed for a long time. But I think what we're lacking, again, is not the vision, it's the power to get there. So I think the hope is in doing the hard work of organizing, talking to workers, rebuilding our base, making sure that people understand, yes, your right to be mad, your right to be mad that your wages aren't keeping pace with the cost of living in this country, but you're pointing at the wrong things. The people who are taking all the money are the ones that have all the money. That's the organizing that we need to be doing in earnest. And then when we get there, we will have a lot more ability to put things on the table that workers want and need. Because right now, nobody's really listening to workers.
No, you're absolutely right. And this is where I, you know, on election day, I said, you know, the sad reality is the country's made this choice. I'm not thrilled with it, but we're going to have to go through what's coming. The pain, the suffering that we predicted during the election that was going to come and is going to come. And out of that, the hope is that we'll organize. And we got to go through this painful period. There's going to be a lot of suffering. And the line that I kept using is the solutions for our future will come out of the suffering due to their savagery. And they are proving to be as savage as I predicted in 2024. So it's the groundwork that you're laying. It's groups like yours. It's the push to educate, activate, and engage people. Because as things happen, they have to know why. So this is what I think the right has done masterfully over the years in talking with working people where, you know, everybody else, not so much.
Yeah, I think it's so important that we speak to working people's issues and don't let ourselves get distracted in responding to everything else that's happening. All the culture war issues. You know, I'm a person who cares deeply about civil rights and human rights. I believe in equal opportunity in the workplace. I believe in the right to organize, but we need to make sure that we are speaking to the things that people are feeling every single day. They're not making enough money to get by. Many people in this country are living with absolutely no rights on the job, no ability to speak up if things are, they feel like they can't speak up if things are unsafe because there's no one to protect them if they blow the whistle on their employer.
No, look, I've said before, you know, the reason corporations are so against union workers is because they're empowered workers, and empowered workers become empowered citizens. And the last thing the wealth class of this country wants is a group of empowered workers, not just in the job, but in society as a whole. And I fear that you know, again, I go back to this divide in this country where people feel some power is in things that are harmful, I think, does. A lot of the culture war stuff that they believe that this, I could affect this because they feel helpless in affecting their standard of living, their health care situations, their education situations. It seems that way to me. Do you come along?
Yeah, I mean, I think one reason that corporations and authoritarians don't like unions is because they're very democratic. They do empower workers. You do have the right to speak up for what you believe is right in your workplace. That's actually a right people have with or without a union, but I think a lot of people don't always remember that. And of course, there is power in numbers. So it's not separate from fighting authoritarianism, right? Building a union is a great way to help protect democracy. And unions have always been a powerful voice for democracy and fairness.
So we've got a potential government shutdown coming on the horizon. Because I want to, again, there are things we're not talking about. There are only a couple of legislative days left. How does that affect working people? Because I've had a number of people go, what do I care? The government doesn't do anything for me. Walk me through why this is a working class issue.
I think a lot of people are coming to grips with the importance of the many roles that federal workers have. People have an idea that they're, you know, a bunch of bureaucrats in DC. In fact, they have critical roles in making sure that our workplaces are safe, that our food is inspected, that you can get your Social Security check on time, that if you need some help signing up for services, that there's somebody there to do that. So I think that working people will feel it, just as working people are beginning to feel now, you know, the attacks on government employees at the beginning of the administration. We're on track to lose about 300,000 jobs in the federal workforce between, you know, layoffs and people, agencies closing, people being pushed out. those things affect all of us. So yes, it affects you in the services that people depend on for their government, from their government, whether or not they realize it, but it also affects our economy overall.
So let me ask you this, because you know, there are a lot of, there are going to be a lot of government jobs that are going to be lost, many of them to AI. And I think we've done a really horrible job of getting ahead of AI. In fact, I personally think the cat's out of the bag. We're never going to restrain this animal, and it's going to be really, really destructive. So looking at it from my pessimistic point of view, is there any hope in this? Because I do view, I do see a lot of those jobs being replaced. And the fact that, is this an issue that you think people can, you know, Democrats, sane Republicans, you know, folks can coalesce around and maybe bring some sanity back?
Setting aside for this for a second, the idea whether there's any bipartisan agreement on this, I think what we know is that we need a worker voice as AI is rolled out in workplaces, right? So yes, there's the framework of what jobs may be lost, what work may be shifted to AI, and what happens to workers as a result. But there's also what happens to workers who are still in a workplace where AI is used increasingly to control their daily tasks, to set the pace of their work, to watch over what they're doing. There's a lot of implications, for instance, for making it easier for an employer to bust unions and spy on employees. But we know that where workers have a voice, it is not necessarily the case that AI in a workplace has to be the wholly a destructive force. There could be good applications of it as well, as long as the workers have a seat at the table, have a right to have a say, and it's not all just sort of turned over to corporations who, you know, we know what their motivation is, to increase profits for CEOs and shareholders.
Yeah. So your organization, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the folks at the center that you're at, you know, what do you want people doing? What's the organizing that you're working on? What are you pulling people towards? Because you said a moment ago, kind of need a vision, kind of need something to rally around. Is there that you know, is there that message that you're sending out?
Well, I think people have been united for a while around the idea that we need a rebalancing of worker power. I think there are a lot of interesting discussions going on right now saying, what does that look like in 2025? What is it that workers really need to be able to get to a better place? You know, even if we have, there obviously is not a short-term path in this Congress to pass something like the PRO Act. Even if we had the PRO Act, that probably is not nearly enough at this point to rebalance power between corporations and workers. So I think there are a lot of people experimenting with different tactics, but again, I think a lot of this has to be talking to workers, talking to communities, telling the stories that what has happened is not by accident. This has been a decades-long corporate plan to make sure that workers don't have the power of unions, that they don't have laws and regulatory agencies that can protect them. You know, it's always pushing toward the ability of corporations to make more and more money, of, you know, politicians who pretend to be pro-worker but in many cases are not, not doing the things that we know will actually empower workers.
Yeah, I mean, you see, my hope is that someone will come forth with, here's the message, here's the organizing, here's the direction. Because you talk to my friends on the right, they got the message. It's been think tank tested, you know, focus group tested, think tank approved. They've got it. You ask any conservative what they stand for, they're going to tell you, even if it's BS, smaller government, lower taxes, and free enterprise. I think the other side has to come up with. Yeah. Kind
so
of that.
I mean, our job is by nature more difficult because our power comes from numbers, right? It is workers literally in solidarity standing together, and that just requires a lot of conversations, a lot of education, a lot of making sure that people are getting accurate news about what this administration is actually doing that's damaging to workers.
Yeah.
They are doing things that are literally putting workers' health and safety at risk. People need to be hearing that message. And then when we're doing it right as progressives, it's not, you know, one leader telling everybody, okay, here's the plan and here's the message. It is letting the, it is empowering people, listening to their stories, lifting up their voices, and then letting them lead. That's how democracy is supposed to work too, right? We need to be talking to all the time the workers, especially the workers who've organized in the last several years in incredibly difficult conditions. There are workers who are obviously, you know, Starbucks, REI, Chipotle, a lot of other places that are fighting for their first union contracts. We also have workers that have organized and against the odds won first contracts, even in this very bad environment that we have for workers' rights. So that's a big part of the work that we're trying to do at the center. And at the Progressive Caucus Action Fund is to make sure that we are listening to workers, lifting up those voices, making sure that those messages get to members of Congress, people who are doing policy work, but also to other working people to say it doesn't have to be this way. We can build change. We have to be willing to stand together. And I think that those workers can point us to some of the solutions to what are the things that in the short term, until we can have the comprehensive labor law reform that we desperately need, what are those short term steps that we need that will help create that bridge to get back to where we need to be as a country?
There you go. ProgressiveCaucusCenter.org, the website. If you want to check out Sarah Steffen's work, she's the Worker Power Director there at the Progressive Caucus Action Fund. Sarah, I appreciate you taking time. Great stuff. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something in there you go, hey, yeah, I can get behind. I want to hear your thoughts. Quick break, right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2004. That was not a good day for hockey fans. The National Hockey League owners locked out the players. The owners and the players' union could not come to an agreement on issues including pay, free agency rules, and drug testing. League owners also wanted to implement a salary cap. The Players Association objected. The first game of the season was supposed to take place on October 13th. But across the country, the arenas stood silent. As the impasse dragged on, in February, the league announced the season was canceled. The Associated Press reported, quote, "A hockey season on the brink is now a season gone bust." The NHL canceled what was left of its decimated schedule Wednesday after a round of last gasp negotiations failed to resolve differences over a salary cap, the flashpoint issue that led to a lockout. The article continued, quote, "No Stanley Cup champion will be crowned. The first time that's happened since 1919, when the two-year-old league called off the finals because of a flu epidemic. It was the first time that a North American professional sports league lost a full season to a labor dispute. Some of the players found work in the European leagues at greatly reduced pay. It's estimated that the league lost $2 billion in the lockout and that players lost $1 billion in salaries. The impact of the lockout rippled throughout restaurants and other businesses that relied on the hockey crowds, causing layoffs for waitstaff. Finally, in July, an agreement was reached. The players gave in to the owners' demand for a salary cap. In 2012, another lockout by management cost NHL players another half of the season. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, you know, here's the thing. I'm waiting for Democrats. I'm waiting for, you know, Republicans to come out with a working class message that I think could draw this country back together. I mean, we're in this, as I said at the beginning, we're in this really divided place, and working class issues are not being addressed at all. And, you know, I think back to, you know, the 28 presidential campaign was a chicken in every pot, a car in every driveway. This idea that you were going to have this broad shared prosperity, working people, they were even going to be able to,
granted, it was the tail end of the roaring 20s, and we head right into that depression, but at least there was some optimism, and Hoover's policies made things a lot worse. Whole nother thing. But it was the sentiment, you know, a chicken in every pot, a car in every driveway means, you know, hey, you can work hard, play by the rules, you get ahead. And then after the Depression, during the Depression, you had Roosevelt, you know, going, hey, happy days are here again. You know, the hope of millions of people that, you know, maybe we're going to get through this Depression, that there are going to be some job changes. Roosevelt's policies followed up, the CCC, the WPA, all of the things that all these years later, we're still benefiting from. You know, even Woodrow Wilson. During his term, you know, was pushing for the eight-hour day. The man of the eight-hour day, he was called. Vote for eight, Wilson. You know, LBJ, you know, all the way with LBJ was one of their political slogans about the idea of reducing poverty, civil rights, economic opportunity, shared prosperity. Even Reagan, with, you know, just simply asking, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, at least throwing some interest in working class issues. And Trump, look, you know, Trump did a much better job of reaching people with, I'm going to solve all of your problems. Did he? No, not yet. And I don't think ever. I think things are going to get a lot worse. And this is where I think Democrats, sane Republicans, you're going to need to come up with that message. You know, and what is that going to be? You know, I've said before, my vision of this is, you know, how are you going to make my life better? What policies are you going to move to give opportunity for my children? What aspirational messaging are you looking at? Because as we pointed out at the beginning, it's going to get a lot worse. And while we're being distracted and divided, while we're being sliced and diced and pitted against each other, the big problems, the shared problems, they're not going away. They're going to get worse, and at someone's benefit. And it's not going to be you. It's not going to be me. It's not going to be us. It's not going to be the wealth class who pays the bills. It's going to be us. It's not going to be the people sitting in the ivory towers looking down on the unwashed masses. It's going to be us who suffer and sacrifice and pay the price. It's going to be our children who get less opportunity and are every moment controlled. So when I talk with Sarah about AI, because I think AI is one of these places, right, left, center, every working person gets it. Because it's not just creeping anymore into the workplace. It's a full frontal assault at this point. There are literally cameras everywhere. You know, I went to Home Depot and, you know, I was talking to the person at the counter, and they're like, yeah, they're like six cameras watching us and recording everything we do, everything that's going on. They know everything. They know how long you go to the bathroom. They know how long it takes. You're talking to a customer. They even know if you're not talking about hardware. And I'm like, really? And they're like, yeah, you know, I was talking to somebody and we veered off into another topic and I got spoken to. I'm like, but isn't that your job to talk? Never mind. You're not doing it in the right way. And we're quickly getting to a place where every moment of our existence is being monitored and monetized. And the question I keep coming back to is, when do we say enough? And this, to me, is a political opportunity. Will someone take advantage of it? I don't know. But every working person I talk to, red hat, blue hat, no hat, this is a concern to them. Maybe not as much as I would like to see, but it's still a concern. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you okay with the self-checkouts? You okay with AI phone calls? You okay with you know, your doctor's office, you know, maybe having your x-rays looked at? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Tell me what you think about a society of people who don't work anymore. And at the behest of the benevolent billionaire class. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. Tyler Robinson, the suspect in the shooting death of far-right activist Charlie Kirk, made his first appearance in a Utah court via video link. Judge Tony Graff read the charges against Robinson, seven altogether, including aggravated murder.
In that on September 10th, 2025, in Utah County, the defendant, Tyler James Robinson, intentionally or knowingly caused the death of Charlie Kirk.
Prosecutors said they'd be seeking the death penalty. In New York, a judge dismissing terrorism charges against Luigi Mangione, the suspect in the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. But the rest of the indictment stands. The Menendez brothers have lost an attempt to get a new trial for the 1989 murders of their parents in Beverly Hills. Police investigating the death of a black college student found hanging from a tree on the campus of Delta State University in Mississippi. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump has announced that he's been retained by the student's family. This is ABC News. The Food and Drug Administration.